Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I can't think of a better example of polarization in American politics than the impeachment trial that's taking place, where there's no middle ground at all, no willingness to listen or consider the evidence. The political commentator Ezra Klein has just written a book called Why We're Polarized that attempts to explain all of this, how our political views have absolutely collapsed into a kind of identity politics that is non-negotiable. Ezra Klein talks with Isaac Chotiner later this hour. But first, it's the season for one of our great annual traditions at the New Yorker Radio Hour, when we bestow the most prestigious honor in filmmaking, the Brody Awards. The Brodies, unlike the Oscars, aren't decided by a huge pool of unaccountable people floating around Hollywood, but by one guy, Richard Brody. Richard writes about film for NewYorker.com, and he sees more movies in a week than most people see in 5 years. Joining me to do the honors here today is staff writer Alexandra Schwartz, who writes about theater and books, but who's basically here for the M&Ms and the popcorn.
It's Hello. That time of it's year that, again.
It's the most magical time of the
it's
year.
It's the most magical time in the year.
So here we are, surrounded by M&Ms, cheese doodles that aren't quite cheese doodles, and some popcorn. And we are ready to go on the Brodies. Welcome, Alex. Welcome, Richard.
Glad to be here.
And what we're going to do is we're going to just do four awards, the biggies. Best actress, best actor, both in leading roles, best director, and best picture. And of course, these are all Richard's nominees, not the Academy's.
Alas.
I don't think so.
In a better world.
So let's get right down to it. Let's start with the acting awards. First up is Best Actress in a Leading Role. Alex, the Brody nominees, please.
Cynthia Erivo for Harriet. Adele Hanel, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Lupita Nyong'o, Us. Elizabeth Moss, Her Smell. And Melissa McCarthy, The Kitchen. And the winner is...
Lupita Nyong'o for Us.
Once... upon a time, there was a girl, and the girl had a shadow.
Richard, the last I looked, she was not even nominated by the Academy. What happened? What was the source of the snub, or is it just the same old, same old?
Well, I think, first of all, the enthusiasm for Us is simply less than the enthusiasm for Get Out was, and I think for very invidious reasons. I think that Jordan Peele here made a film that is no less a political film than Get Out, but its politics are not centered on the politics of race. And I think that, weirdly and unpleasantly, the Academy, like many critics, expects something very particular from an African-American filmmaker.
Very particular and very predictable.
And very predictable, yeah. From an African-American filmmaker that they did not get in this movie. On the other hand, Us is a much more comprehensive political movie.
Tell me a little bit about her performance. What distinguished it so much for you?
On the one hand, she creates characters who are entirely comprehensible, plausible, and precise in their milieu. And on the other hand, she captures something exemplary of the, let's say, the metaphysical experience, the haunting experience, that makes it one of the most powerful political metaphors of the time.
Now, who do you think's actually going to win? Who's the Academy going to pick?
I think it's going to be very tough. The Academy likes biopics. I think that Renee Zellweger has a very good chance for Judy. I think her main competitor is going to be Scarlett Johansson for Marriage Story.
No way.
I think that she delivers the kind of performance which is simultaneously vulnerable and triumphant that will appeal to voters.
What did you expect was going to happen?
I don't know. I guess I didn't think it through. But I thought we agreed we weren't going to use lawyers.
I'm trying to say this as undramatically as possible. I want an entirely different kind of life.
Alex, you got a winner for the Academy in your own choice?
For Best Actress?
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'd have to pick Saoirse Ronan for Little Women. I mean, I am a fan of Little Women, the movie. I am irritated that Greta Gerwig was not nominated, as I feel she should have been.
Best director.
For best director. And I thought that Saoirse Ronan was a great Spunky Jo.
All right, let's go on to best actor in a leading role. Alex?
Robert De Niro for The Irishman. Adam Driver, The Dead Don't Die. Winston Duke for Us. Adam Sandler, Uncut Gems. And Paul Walter Hauser for Richard Jewell. And Richard, the winner is...
Adam Sandler, Uncut Gems.
Adam Sandler, who didn't get nominated. Adam Sandler, who seemed to maybe, I think the polite word is, got screwed.
Yeah, absolutely got screwed.
Why did he get screwed?
He got screwed because he's in a movie that is a...
makes you a nervous wreck from beginning to end.
It's a frenzied, daring movie. It also features an actor whom the Academy doesn't take seriously.
He got screwed because he's Adam Sandler, I think, in part. And I did see an interview that he did where he said that if he did not get nominated, he was going to drop a stink bomb of a movie on all of us to as revenge. And so I think we can look forward to that. But,
I can't wait.
Yeah, that's what the Academy thinks of Adam Sandler. But I'm totally with Richard on this one.
Uncut Gems is the story of a man who is digging his own grave. It's the story of a gambler. His life is on the line at every step of the way. He works in the Diamond District. He has a shop where he provides bling for basketball players. Kevin Garnett plays himself in this movie.
And he's kind of good.
And he's really good.
Yeah.
How many carats is this?
What, 4,000 or 5,000 carats? $3,000 a carat? Ooh. I'm not...
Why has it got so many colors in it, man? What is this?
That's the thing. They say you can see the whole universe in opals. That's how f***ing old they are.
Holy shit.
I've been telling you. That's why I'm wanting you to see it.
Yo, that's crazy, man. Yeah.
From stone to stone. Garnet's a stone. You know that. That's a $1 million opal you're holding. Straight from the Ethiopian Jewish tribe. I mean, this is old school, Middle Earth.
Got a dinosaur gym.
Yes, man. A dinosaur. That's
well, I think the secret to Uncut Gems is that he worked with directors who had an idea about what Adam Sandler could and should be. Now, it's by working with the most talented directors that actors expand their range.
I also thought he was very good in the Meyerowitz stories by Noah Baumbach.
Yeah, I agree.
So mischief is being played all throughout your list here. One of the pieces of mischief is that you nominated Adam Driver, not surprisingly, for best actor in a leading role, but you didn't nominate him for Marriage Story. You nominated him for a zombie movie directed by Jim Jarmusch called The Dead Don't Die. Why?
The Dead Don't Die is one of the great political movies of the time, and that seems to be a theme that's coming up this year. This has been a year of remarkable political films. The Dead Don't Die is a climate change horror story.
Is this some sort of epidemic or what?
It's zombies.
What are you saying?
Well, it's the undead. They've been reanimated. Caused by the Earth having been pulled off its axis. Caused by the polar fracking.
But the authorities and energy people keep saying that's not true. Really? Ah! Oh, my God! She's alive?
No, she's not. She's just undead.
Chardonnay.
Holy shit, did she just say Chardonnay?
Yeah, she did.
Now, let's move on to Best Director. Alex, who are the nominees?
I'll just finish eating my cheese doodle. The nominees. Jordan Peele for Us. Marielle Heller, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Jim Jarmusch for The Dead Don't Die. Josh and Benny Safdie, Uncut Gems. Martin Scorsese, The Irishman. And the winner is...
This was very tough, by the way. The winner is Jordan Peele for Us.
Why so tough?
Because everybody's great this year. 2019 was an extraordinary year for really inventive direction. What got me about Us is that it's a colossal movie. It's a movie that starts from a very particular experience and really takes on, like, the world.
Now, Richard, the big news about, not that it's unique news from year to year, but the big news in Best Director is there are no women, notably, as you've mentioned before, Alex.
No Greta Gerwig.
What is up? I mean, this category is particularly horrible when it comes to this.
And this
issue.
Year was a great year for women making movies.
I think if you look at the list of directors nominated by the Academy, the results are dinosauric. The results are...
Who exemplifies a dinosauric choice?
Well, Sam Mendes, Todd
Phillips. Of 1917.
Yeah, even Quentin Tarantino, whose quality of direction has declined drastically over the years as he has become more attentive to his writing.
Richard, one movie that is all over the Academy's list, to many people's delight, including mine, but is nowhere to be seen on your list, is Parasite. Why did it not make the cut for you?
Parasite is a classic case of a pretty good movie. It's made by a director who has an authentic need to make this movie. You feel that he has something he wants to say. It's motivated by passion.
And what he has to say has to do with rich and poor.
Exactly.
Advantage, disadvantage.
I think that fundamentally, he simply wanted to show spaces. He wanted to show that there are places that look one way where rich people live and that look another way where sewage spews out when there are storms where poor people live.
Alex?
I have to say I found the film to be a lot more inventive and working on a lot more levels than my colleague here.
You know when you call your colleague, it's like in the Senate, the gentlewoman from South Carolina.
Yeah. My beloved and esteemed colleague here. To me, Parasite was the movie that I wanted us to be. It had a more coherent vision. I thought visually it was more arresting and precise. I also thought the cast was terrific, and the cast has been overlooked by the Academy in a way that doesn't entirely surprise me. There is a lot of humor in that family dynamic. The family, which begins with a son who gets a job as a tutor at a wealthy family's house and scams the rest of his family into the same house, the same household. That's really a kind of twisted love that I appreciated seeing on screen.
Let's go on to the final best picture, the main event. Alex, the nominees, please.
The nominees are A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, Atlantics, The Dead Don't Die, The Irishman, An Elephant Sitting Still, Frankie, Her Smell, Little Women, Uncut Gems, and Us. And the winner is?
The winner is The Irishman, which is the gangster movie.
Someone gasped!
To end all gangster movies.
I'm sorry, but I thought, you know, the way things were going, it looked like Us.
Brent, how are you? Listen, I got that kid I was talking to you about here. I'm going to put him on the phone and let you talk to him, okay?
Hello?
Is that Frank?
Yes.
Hiya, Frank. This is Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah.
Glad to meet you.
Well, glad to meet you, too. Even if it's over the phone. I heard you paint houses.
Yes, sir, I do. And I also do my own carpentry.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. I understand you're a brother of mine.
Yes, sir. Local 107 since 1947.
Yeah. You know, our friend speaks very highly of you.
Well, thank you.
He's not an easy man to please.
Well, I do my best.
The Irishman is not to be denied. It's the kind of big historical movie that very few directors dare make, and even fewer can make well. In case anyone ever suspected that Martin Scorsese romanticized the mafia, that shibboleth is completely debunked in The Irishman, the subject of which is organized crime has been rotting out American society for the last 70 years, at least. Politics, business, family life, community life, there is no aspect of American life that is not completely corrupted by organized crime.
But let me ask you, as a fan of The Irishman and as a huge fan of Scorsese, is there a little bit of having your cake and eating it too? On the one hand, you were saying, well, you know, the mob, in fact, this is an anti-romantic film. It's the opposite of The Godfather. On the other hand, it's an incredibly romantic project, his pictures about the mob.
Well, Scorsese's very story is temptation. This is, in some weird way, a deeply metaphysical film, the subject of which is the loss of a person's soul. But it's not just loss of a person's soul. It's the loss of collective soul.
Richard, among your nominees are some big and big-name movies, The Irishman, Little Women, even Us. But as is customary, you have a number of films on your Best Picture list that probably not a hell of a lot of people have seen this year. Of all of those, what's the one that you dearly hope everybody out there gets to see at some point or another? One. You get one.
I have one to add if it's not yours, Richard.
It's the one with a title that seems most obscure, namely An Elephant Sitting Still. It's a four-hour-long Chinese movie made by a young director named Hu Bo. There's an unfortunate story involving him. He killed himself before the film was released. So it's his first feature and his last feature. It starts out as a very simple story of a teenage boy who is accused of stealing a cell phone, and from there it expands to a spectacle, a quiet, intimate spectacle of utter degradation in daily life. It is not a fun movie, but it's a deeply moving film.
Alex?
My choice would be Atlantics by Matty Diop, a French-Senegalese director, and actually it makes a really nice pairing with one of my other favorite movies of the year, The Souvenir by Joanna Hogg. They're both movies about young women who are in love and deeply affected by loss. They both have unique viewpoint. The Matty Diop movie, which you can also see on Netflix, like The Irishman, is visually stunning. And what it does with the idea of migration and these dangerous travels across the sea that many of us read about in the news is spectacular.
Richard, was this a good year for movies all in all?
This was a fantastic year for movies all in all. This is a year of unbelievably audacious filmmaking. And the one theme that brings the best films of the year together is the underground, whether the criminal underworld in The Irishman, whether the zombies in The Dead Don't Die, whether the doubles in Us, or even Parasite. The main theme of the year is there's a second world doubling this world and menacing it.
Alex Schwartz and Richard Brody, thanks so much.
David, thank you. Alex, thank you.
See you next year for the Brodies 2021.
Wouldn't miss it. Richard Brody. You can find all his picks for best films and actors of 2019 at NewYorker.com. Alex Schwartz is a staff writer, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman, and I host a podcast called Design Matters from the TED Audio Collective. Every episode, I have conversations with designers, writers, artists, and other luminaries of contemporary thought. People like Roman Mars, Ai Weiwei, Ethan Hawke, and Ashley Ford. We not only talk about their crafts, but how they design the arc of their lives, what they've learned, what obstacles they've overcome, and how they've done it, and how they see the world. Join us for an inquiry into the broader world of creative culture. Find and follow Design Matters with Debbie Millman wherever you're listening to this.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Last week, we spent the full hour of our program on the topic of mass incarceration. I was joined for that by Kai Wright, who's the host of WNYC's election podcast, The United States of Anxiety. And we talked about how imprisonment soared during the war on drugs and the emerging consensus that mass incarceration, whatever the intention, had caused incalculable harm, especially in Black and Latino communities. At the end of that episode, we touched on the future of prison reform, in particular the movement known as prison abolition, what it is, and maybe just as importantly, what it isn't.
I think the place to begin is that for a lot of people listening, I imagine, just the words prison abolition are probably a bit of a head scratch. What does that mean? What are you talking about?
Kai Wright joins us again this week in conversation with two prominent advocates of prison abolition, Paul Butler, a law professor who was a federal prosecutor in Washington, and Sujatha Baliga, an attorney who leads the Restorative Justice Project. She was recently awarded the MacArthur Genius Grant for her work.
Sujatha, can I start with you and ask you to just sort of explain to you what that means?
So to my mind, I come to prison abolition personally from a series of perspectives, and one is from a practical place. So mass incarceration and mass criminalization more broadly has not met even its own stated goals of keeping us safer, of deterring crime and harm, of rehabilitating folks who we put behind bars, of effectively containing crime. And so that's sort of on the practical level. And then on a deeper level, in terms of when I think about mass criminalization most broadly, has played itself out in extremely race-based and racist ways. And so I come to prison abolition and this notion that we can have a world without prisons. We would do better to have a world without prisons.
And Paul, what would you add to that? This idea that, okay, well, prison abolition is first off a way to think that there's a world without prisons. What would you add to that in terms of what we would do?
When I first heard the term prison abolition, I thought it was crazy. I'm a former prosecutor, and the idea that we wouldn't punish people who caused harm seemed ludicrous. But then, as I thought about my experience locking up mainly African-American and Latinx people, almost all of whom were poor, and I thought about the impact that I had on my community, it wasn't at all what I was expecting. And so then I started listening to what abolitionists were talking about. And the first way I got enrolled was by hearing what it wasn't, what it doesn't mean. Prison abolition doesn't mean that everybody who's locked up gets to come home tomorrow. Think of it as a process of gradual decarceration. We let as many people as possible come home, but keeping an eye on public safety. So we do it in a way that's consistent with everybody being safe. And a lot of abolitionists have this term called the dangerous few. And the dangerous few is the idea that there's a really small number of people who may need to be supervised for the safety of everyone else. We have no idea how many people this is. We know it's way smaller than the 2.5 million people who are locked up today.
Paul, you mentioned this idea of the dangerous few, I think you said. I imagine that will come right to a lot of folks' minds. Sujatha, if we're talking about a world without prisons, what are we talking about doing with people who are a violent threat?
So I would suggest that the vast majority of people who commit acts of violence are actually not being incarcerated and cease their behavior without state intervention. There's far more violence happening in America today than is ever on the radar of the criminal legal system. Just taking domestic violence, for example, 50% of survivors do not contact the system at all. And of those who do, 20% say it made us less safe, right? So, and as a survivor myself of child sexual abuse and rape, I have never, ever thought to contact the system to make me more safe, right? And so there were other ways in which the violence and harm that happened in my life, including direct confrontations with people who have harmed me, supported by family and community and friends and things of that nature, right, have prevented that harm from happening again. I'm not talking about vigilantism. I'm talking about structured processes where conversations are facilitated, that people are held accountable for being their best selves.
Both of you have mentioned a bit of your personal story that brought you to this work. Sujatha, can you share with us what brought you into this work? It did involve the sexual assault that you've mentioned.
Absolutely, sure. So you know, throughout my childhood and adolescence, I was sexually abused by my father. And we were living in a small town outside a small town in rural Pennsylvania where, you know, for all of elementary school, I was the only child of color in my school. I experienced a lot of racist bullying. I experienced my father being pulled over by a police officer and being questioned in ways. And sort of our status as American was always really questioned. I wasn't interested in anything that was on offer. Right? I knew a child who had been put in through Child Protective Services in someone else's home who then complained about the sexual harm that she was experiencing in her foster home, right? And so I didn't want my father locked up or my mother, you know, and my sister to have potential immigration consequences. And I surely didn't want to be put in a home with folks who didn't practice my religion, speak my language, eat my food, only to potentially experience harm there, right? I was a smart kid and I kept my mouth shut for far too many years. And so my father passed away when I was in high school, and I was looking for solutions, like what could have helped my family heal. And there was nothing really on offer. There was nothing for me to imagine at that time, really. So, you know, I worked in battered women shelters, as we called them back then, and worked with trafficking survivors briefly, and ultimately applied to law school thinking that I would be a prosecutor because I wanted to lock the quote-unquote bad guys up. And so I had this huge wake-up that these policies actually aren't doing anything. And then I thought about my own childhood and the fact that, hey, why am I pursuing this approach, which I myself had the wisdom to not engage in as a kid?
It's such a striking thing you're describing for you as a kid. You're saying you are in active harm, and you're aware that the thing that we're supposed to do to stop harm, which is call the police, wasn't going to help you. It might actually hurt you.
Yeah, or even tell my teachers, or even tell a grown-up outside our family. I knew not to tell anybody. And, you know, of course, part of that is the nature of child sexual abuse. The fundamental failure of the criminal legal system as it relates to survivors is that it doesn't encourage us to tell the truth. I cannot imagine something closer to gaslighting than the experience of being cross-examined. Abolition, to my mind, isn't just about ending the prisons. It's about ending binary processes which pit us as us, them, right, wrong. Somebody has to be lying. Somebody's telling the truth. That is not the way that we get to healing.
That's Sujatha Baliga talking with Kai Wright about what's generally called restorative justice. Now, Kai, how does restorative justice work? What happens?
Well, David, first off, understand that restorative justice is just one solution. It's one way to think about how we can deal with the harm we do to each other outside of a punishment model. And that's a really important step. It's just not about punishment. It's rather about accountability for what you have done and repair. And so think about it, particularly with violence, for instance, most violent crime, the overwhelming amount of violent crime happens in intimate relationships. So that means we have to first even just think about the language we use, right? So in restorative justice, it's not victim and criminal and perpetrator and things like that. It's survivor. It's person who did harm. It's not about efficiency either. This could be something that takes a few weeks. It could be something that takes a few years. It all is driven by the survivor. And what does the survivor need to feel like the harm that has been done has been repaired? So some examples are, you know, someone who has been a survivor of domestic violence. They may say, listen, I want the person who harmed me, I want them to go volunteer at a domestic violence clinic because I want them to learn about what they did to me. Everything about it is about accountability and restoration and repair as opposed to exile.
Okay, got it.
Paul, you worked for years as a federal prosecutor, as you mentioned earlier. At what point did you look up and say, you know what, this just, it's not working? When did that come to you?
I wanted families to be safe. Communities to be safe. I wanted people who caused harm to be held accountable. And I wanted the process to be fair. And I learned through my day-to-day work, that's not what the criminal legal process is about. And so, sadly, one of the ways that Sujatha's experience is not unique at all is that she didn't choose to involve the criminal legal process. I saw that day-to-day as a prosecutor. We used to say that the only people who got prosecuted were either dumb or had bad luck. So if you look at what is called a clearance rate, That's when the police say they solved a case. It doesn't mean the person gets convicted. It just means the police think they found the quote-unquote bad guy. For homicide, it's 60%. That means that 40% of people literally get away with murder. And homicide has the highest clearance rate. So I think people know that if you call the cops and tell them someone stole your iPhone, they're not going to track down your iPhone. And it turned out that what I was doing, just putting as many people in jail as I could, it was counterproductive. I was sending them to a finishing school for criminals.
And that was really your perspective at the time? You were like, this is, you know, this is the work I'm here to do, is really just lock up as many of these criminals as possible.
And the damn thing was, I loved it at the time that I was doing it. I tell that person, you say you're guilty. Don't make me go through the trouble of putting you on trial, and I'll give you a good deal. If you do go to trial and you lose, and you're going to lose, I'm going to throw the book at you.
Because you've got all the muscle in the world.
And the result of that muscle is that 95% of people who are prosecuted plead guilty. Justice Kennedy said, we don't have a trial system in the United States. We have a plea bargain system. I said that I wanted to be a prosecutor because I don't like bullies. I stopped being a prosecutor because I don't like bullies.
And then you had, as I gather, an experience where you found yourself on the other end of that. Can you describe that experience for us?
So I got arrested and I got prosecuted for a crime that I didn't commit. The judge told the jury, this is a dispute about a parking space and neither one of the people has a car. Things worked out fine. The reason that things worked out fine for me in my little misdemeanor case, because I had the best lawyer in the city. Kai, I had literally prosecuted people in the same courtroom where I was being prosecuted.
That had to be weird. Did they even notice you?
It's very reminiscent of slavery, the way they bring you out in chains, and almost everybody who was brought out were African-American men. And I was thinking, oh, my God, what if the judge recognizes me during this arraignment? The judge didn't even look at me. I wasn't even a human being to that person. I was just a cog in the system.
A big part of the work you're describing when we talk about sort of getting people out of the court system and instead finding new ways to deal with each other, to repair the harm, it does sound like it really depends upon everyone in the community, or at least everyone involved, being willing to do that work, that the whoever has been harmed has to be willing to participate. People have to have the time and the bandwidth to participate, even if they've been in the middle of what might have been quite traumatic situations. I have to imagine that you've come up across times when that just doesn't work, when people can't or won't show up in that way. What then?
Getting the right people in the room is a bit of the work, right? And, you know, if a crime survivor says, listen, I don't want to be in the room with the person, but I want to send in my cousin instead to talk to him, or I've written a letter and I want somebody else to read it, or I want to do it through, you know, I want to be on a speakerphone, or I want to be in the next room, you know, listening in. And then maybe if I feel comfortable halfway through, I'll come in. Like anything that can accommodate that person feeling safe and good about the participation.
Right. Can I ask you both to sort of actually answer some of these questions about, like, how do we do it? Because I think for a lot of people, that's a question. Okay, so what does this really look like? Okay, so prisons are gone. And say you have, you know, someone who has, let's take the worst case scenarios, that is a violent offender, they're a repeat violent offender, I've been a victim of, and I say, hey, I want them punished. What happens now? How does that unfold?
So my organization, Impact Justice, we're working with 7 jurisdictions across the nation right now, and we're looking to build it out to 21, ideally over time, where we are helping build diversion programs, restorative justice diversion programs. And we've gotten quite a few up and off the ground already. And so what we've seen after hundreds of cases have been done in places like Oakland and San Francisco and Richmond, California now, and many cases have gone through a program in Nashville, Tennessee. We're starting up in Miami, where we're seeing amazing results. So the recidivism data is astounding. In Oakland, California, we've seen a 44% reduction in recidivism. So this is a pre-charge process where these cases don't even go to court at all. To be clear, like, there's no attorneys assigned. We're never labeling this person the defendant. We're never stripping them of their humanity, but rather immediately handing them over to communities that they are already embedded in and living in, and really helping them come to a deeper understanding of how to be accountable without feeling lousy about yourself, but instead getting to feel great about yourself when you fix stuff that you mess up, because people mess up. We are humans and we make errors. Some of them are small. Some of them are huge. They are all capable of being healed and addressed.
So, Paul, I mean, certainly the money is where the rubber meets the road on so many things. And part of this is we're talking about, you know, I mean, states and federal systems would have to defund themselves to fund these things. You've been a prosecutor, you're a law professor at Georgetown University. How radical and crazy of an idea are these things to your colleagues?
Most of my colleagues, like most Americans now, understand that the criminal legal process badly needs reform. And so even when they hear about not abolitionist projects, but just common sense proposals from people like the Brennan Institute in New York, which says that 40% of people who are incarcerated right now can come home and we wouldn't even notice it. These are people who are mainly in there for nonviolent offenses, drug crimes, or low-level violent offenses like theft, or people who've aged out of any propensity to cause violence. There are literally prisons that are opening up assisted living facilities. This is how it's going to work. Three steps: moratorium, decarceration, and excarceration. Moratorium, stop building the cages. Just don't construct any more prisons. And I think a lot of people understand why that's a responsible project. Decarceration, finding ways for people to come home who are locked up now. And the last step is excarceration, preventing people from being incarcerated in the first place. And people get that. One of the things I tell them about is the million-dollar blocks in New York City. This organization, Justice Mapping Project, they did this map of New York, and they highlight blocks, just one city block, where the government is spending $1 million just to lock up the kids and young people on that one block. And so I say, what if rather than spending that money putting people in cages, it was spent on health care, on better schools, on job training? Wouldn't that make us all safer?
A person who talks about this so beautifully is Danielle Sarid, who runs an organization called Common Justice, and she just wrote a book. And it's really beautiful, this description that I've heard her say on multiple occasions. If you put a bunch of people in a desert, and they're walking across a desert for months, and then suddenly there's a hamburger stand there, you can't say that just because everybody's lined up for hamburgers, that nobody's a vegetarian, or that this is the best hamburger stand in this desert, right? And that is what we do for survivors with justice. We say that justice is punishment, that justice is a trial, and that if you don't get this person to go away for as long as possible, there's no justice. No one has interrogated the question about whether or not survivors actually want that. Have we ever taken starving survivors to a buffet and then take a poll about whether or not people chose this or that food? Or even to ask people what they want when they're not starving?
I mean, so is this a what do you think? Is this a 5-year turnaround? Is this a 10-year turnaround? Is this a 50-year turnaround to get people to see it that way?
Unfortunately, I think from history about the abolition of slavery in the United States, conservatively 200 years. So while I wish it could happen tomorrow, I understand that any abolition movement takes a long time, requires a lot of dedication. But what I can say with confidence is that in 100 years, we're not going to be locking human beings in cages. Because we'll understand then, as we understand about slavery now, that it was immoral. And we'll also understand about prison that it just didn't work.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
Law professor Paul Butler. And we heard from Sujatha Baliga, who leads the Restorative Justice Project. They spoke with WNYC's Kai Wright. Kai is the host of WNYC's podcast, The United States of Anxiety. The new season starts January 30th, and Kai and his team will be traveling across the country reporting on how the past resonates in this year's election and meeting people like Vernita Blocker, who grew up in rural Mississippi.
For me, it was just a way of life. I never thought I was poor until much later. We were surrounded by people who did not own land. They lived on someone else's land. They lived in someone else's house. And it was just always drilled into me, as long as you have breath in your body, to just hold on to the land. Don't ever sell it.
That's the upcoming series, The United States of Anxiety. And this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Ezra Klein is a political commentator and a self-described policy wonk who's very much willing to get into the weeds of how government actually works. He hosts a political podcast aptly called The Ezra Klein Show. Klein's first book is just out, and it aims to tackle a huge question. The book is called simply, Why We're Polarized. And one of Klein's major themes here is that policies are now far less important to who we elect than who we identify with. In other words, that partisanship has become a kind of identity politics, and it's very hard to change someone's mind about their identity. Ezra Klein talked about his book with Isaac Chotiner, who writes the Q&A column for The New Yorker.
Well, I want to ask you about the Democratic race in the context of this book a little bit, because you've essentially written this book, and you're saying you're saying that things like healthcare, that's not how our political system is where it is because of the debate over healthcare. They're much larger issues of identity. And if you want to understand American politics, you have to understand these much larger forces that are going on. And yet, if you look at the Democratic debate, there is a lot of very intricate policy debate about bills or, you know, issues that are probably not going to pass the Senate no matter what happens. You know, it's certainly a contrast to the Republican primary of 4 years ago, where there was racism on the stage and people were yelling at each other. And it was crazy in many ways. But in some ways, it feels like a more accurate reflection of where American politics is. And I'm wondering if you think the Democratic debate, as good as it is to talk about policy and as important as it is actually sort of different from the main conversation about what's really going on in politics now.
I don't think so. I don't think that Democrats debating policy, that actually goes very deep, in part because it's a party of very different groups. You have to sort of win people over through transactional policy. But the bigger point I would make here, and I say this as somebody whose whole career is covering policy, it's a mistake to think that policy is not a way people express identity. And in particular, Bernie Sanders is genius at this. When Bernie Sanders talks about Medicare for All and the way he talks about Medicare for All, he's not just making a policy argument. He's making an argument about values and who he is. And I think you see this in the way the Democratic policy debates play out. They're not really having like a clear debate over who has the idea that is most likely, given the composition of the U.S. Senate and the House, to pass, right? Thus that you will get the most people health care. I mean, you will hear that from Amy Klobuchar, but that's not the way this thing has played out in its macro form. Bernie Sanders has made Medicare for All a kind of litmus test. It's about, are you a certain kind of person who believes a certain set of things about the world and is built on a certain set of value foundations? And so then when Elizabeth Warren, who I think is a good counterexample here, She, as far as I can tell, believes in Medicare for All. She came out with a very detailed financing plan for Medicare for All, which he hasn't. But then she also came out with this transitionary bill, which she felt would help solve some of these political problems. And the reaction to that among the Bernie Sanders wing of the party was not, oh, that's interesting. Like, let's kind of go back and forth. The reaction was, oh, you're not a true, pure, diehard Medicare for All supporter. You will compromise. And when you see something like that, what you're seeing is policy operating at a symbolic level. It's not just operating as who has the best theory for how to get to Medicare for All. You're seeing a sort of identity argument play out about who is truly connected to this, who is truly, in this case, a democratic socialist.
Is there a way in which this might set people up, Democratic voters up, or voters for whoever the Democratic nominee is, for disappointment and
yes.
the same sort of let me finish. For the same sort of cynicism that we see in the system now, and which I think benefits outsiders to the system because of that cynicism about how Washington works, that Democratic politicians now are promising a whole range of things that even if they are elected, and even if they somehow get 50, 51 senators, are very, very unlikely to pass Congress.
I cannot stress yes enough. We did not invent campaign overpromising in the year 2020. There's not a campaign where presidential candidates do not promise more than they're likely to be able to pass. My biggest critique of the rising left, which I have a lot of sympathy with and in many cases agree with in goals, is that it has substituted an ideological critique for an institutional plan. In particular, the critique that has emerged of Barack Obama is that he didn't get all these great things because he was just a neoliberal. And if only he had had a pure and more aggressive form of politics in the way Bernie Sanders does, then he would have gotten it. An argument I'm making in my book is that we imbue too much explanatory power in stories and actions of individuals. For the most part, individuals carry out the biddings of the political system around them. We are much too focused on big promises presidential candidates make and much too light on their plans for institutional reform or their plans for getting around institutional roadblocks in a way that sets up continuous cycles of disappointment and depression.
A lot of writers on the left, a lot of people on the left feel that generally arguments about polarization or partisanship or what's gone wrong in American politics focus too much on both sides being to blame, and that essentially Democrats have moved to the left in the last several decades and have gotten more polarized and partisan, but that essentially Republicans are to blame for where we are. How do you feel about that critique, and how do you feel like your book does or doesn't fit into it?
So I agree with that critique, number one. So polarization is a system that is affecting and afflicting all of us. And that's not just political parties, but us in the media. It has changed how we do our work, how elections are run, how governance functions. It affects culture, what ends up on TV. The Republican Party has responded to polarization in a different way than the Democratic Party. It has moved further right than the Democratic Party has moved left. The Democratic Party operates under conditions of diversity and democracy that the Republican Party does not operate under. And I mean this. In the Democratic primary right now, if you want to become the Democratic Party leader, you have to win liberals in Iowa, white liberals in Iowa, and more independent voters in New Hampshire, and traditionalist African-American voters in South Carolina. And so what it ends up creating is a preference for very coalitional candidates. The Republican Party, which is an overwhelmingly white Christian party that does not have to put together these coalitions of different groups, allows you to go much deeper. Donald Trump was a candidate who very intensely appealed to a particular kind of person, which is how you got him in 2016.
And also in a very polarized system, which you're writing about, someone who wins a major party nomination can get 46% of the vote and win the presidency, even if they're unpopular because there are only two options and people are very partisan and Republicans will largely vote for one person.
Right. So you can run this argument both ways. And so let me do it this way. In 1950, the American Political Science Association releases a report called Towards a Responsible Two-Party System, a very famous report. And what it basically says in a way that sounds very weird to modern ears is there's a huge problem in American politics, and it is that the parties are not polarized. And the argument APSA makes, the political scientists make, is that the most fundamental choice that people make in a system like ours is which party to vote for. But in that period, exactly what you're saying is happening. We don't really know what's going on inside the party. So maybe you vote for Strom Thurmond in the South, but that's also the party of Hubert Humphrey in Minnesota. And so your vote is kind of being taken and turned into a muddle. You were voting for one agenda and you're not getting it. So the reason I say all this is that I think right now within our discourse about polarization, the way people think about it is polarization is breaking the American political system. So what we need to do is turn the clock back on polarization. We need to become depolarized. I would actually argue it in many ways the reverse, in part because I don't think we're going to become depolarized. But another thing you can imagine doing is changing the way American politics works so that it can function amidst conditions of polarization.
So what would fixes look like to make our system more majoritarian?
The tricky thing here is that as soon as I say this, people are going to be like, well, that won't pass because that's a problem. Polarization will make it so nothing can pass. But at a small level, you can imagine things like getting rid of the filibuster, which creates an added supermajority requirement in the Senate. Get rid of the Electoral College. So right now, we have a U.S. president who did not win a majority of votes. We have a Senate majority that did not win a majority of votes. And because of that, we have a Supreme Court majority that was put in place by people who did not win a majority of votes.
Or so, even pluralities of
votes. Or even pluralities in some cases. So you could also do something, and you can imagine this in different levels, right? You could add states, you can take them away, you can court pack, you can not court pack, you can make Puerto Rico and D.C. states, which you should do for justice and equity reasons anyway. You could then imagine the parties competing at the majority level, and that what you have then is more aggressive forms of governance that then the voters have to choose accountability. We've basically made a choice in our political system to have less voter accountability, but less ability for the other party to do things you may not like, that we prefer the muddled accountability that comes from a system tuned towards inaction against the possibility that the we'll have effective governance and the public will like things that I don't like. And I just think that's wrong. I think the way political systems work best is that people can vote in a party. That party can do the things it said it was going to do, and people can decide if they like the outcome of that. I think it's a little bit crazy that we've gotten so attuned to a system that is about making sure people can't get the thing they voted for because we fear that, I don't know, the voters are too stupid to decide if they liked it or not.
Ezra Klein talking with staff writer Isaac Chotiner. Klein's new book is called Why We're Polarized. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Hope you'll join us again next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frohman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Danny Bonner, Allison McAdam, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.